deserves some credit for taking a principled stand. And I honestly believe that, in fact, he's winning the debate right now. We're sitting here talking about, well, the censure, that's politically unwise. Who's defending the president's NSA action? Suddenly everyone's talking about warrantless wiretapping. It's on the table, as Mara just said. Well, maybe he doesn't have legal justification. Impeachment would be too much, but it's certainly fair to question what he's done. I think Feingold has succeeded in casting a big cloud over the president's program here.
So you think this is helping Democrats and hurting Republicans?
Absolutely. As long as the charge is out there and is not rebutted, it helps. And I think it's out there, and Feingold makes his case coherently. He's an impressive politician. He's been a competitive state, Wisconsin. And I think it's very much helping his presidential race.
I agree with Bill that this is good politics in terms of the Democratic Party for Feingold, and the survey you showed backs that up. I don't agree, however, that this is a smart move on his part in terms of damaging the president on this issue. Yeah, it gets a couple of days with people talking about the illegality of the wiretap program, but that program has proved surprisingly, not to say astonishingly, popular with the public. Should be listening in on Al-Qaeda conversations in the United States or Al-Qaeda-related conversations, and it answers overwhelmingly yes. Senator Feingold is in a peculiar position, as you pointed out in your interview with Senator Durbin, to be talking so confidently about how illegal all this is when he hasn't been, is not among those who's been briefed on the program and is essentially therefore talking through his hat. I don't think that's a winner in the long term for the Democrats, although, you know, all kinds of wacky ideas, including impeachment, have a great deal of traction in the Democratic Party. Mara referred to some in the Democratic base who feel that way. I would say that a majority, and probably a quite distinct majority in the Democratic base, feel that way, which is, depending on how you look at it, either a burden for the party in general, or perhaps in the case of Senator Feingold, a blessing.
But you mixed up two things. You mixed up the idea of the popularity of the program with its legality. I don't think I've met an American who says we shouldn't be doing everything we can to prevent another terrorist attack against this country, including surveilling these conversations. But it's not the question people say, oh yeah, therefore we don't need the judges, we don't need the Congress, we don't need anything but to put our trust in the president.
If I'm not mistaken, the leaders of Congress were fully and completely and repeatedly briefed on this. And for Senator Durbin to say, as he did, that those leaders really were powerless to do anything about it because it's classified is utter nonsense. Any of them could very easily have objected in a letter to the president in strong terms.
They did object.
No, excuse me, they did not. There was one weak, little, weird, sort of slightly incomprehensible letter from Senator Rock.
Fox News talking about how this spy network is surprisingly popular and overwhelmingly gets the yes by the public. Of course, this is a very contrived, specialized question. If you are, meaning the U.S. Empire, spying on our basically sidekicks for propaganda, world domination purposes, so-called Al-Qaeda network, do you dumps in America mind this? And of course, many dumps in America playing the proper role that they've been programmed, saying, no, boss, go ahead. But even some of the sorriest dumps in America realize that them spying on them personally, well, it's just another aspect of Imperial War. You know what time it is. Slave time. You're listening to 103.3. 101.1 Santa Cruz with Skid, 104.1 Berkeley, 96.3 Asheville. We got 107.5 Antelope Valley, Propaganda Press. LUVER.com, the world. RadioForAll.net, the universe. Click into the slave web. Just go slaverevoltradio.blogspot.com. Find out what time it is. Tonight, we're going to go into some more chains of the empire. We got all that and a hell of a lot more on 103.3. Slave Revolt.
Everything you know is wrong.
Hello, seekers. Here we go again. And hello, especially to the skeptic inside you who might still believe.
The dollar and change privatized system continues to crush the life out of humanity. The players in this battle are battling for full spectrum dominance, and they are gearing their machine of destruction for more human and planetary catastrophe. In this Ruins of Empire segment,
hello,
called Dollars and Chains, Part 2, Survival of the Slavist, we'll explore how the industrialized, privatized, planetary war is being fueled up, and some aspects of how a slave in revolt must think about preparing ourselves. So let's get started once again in this Dollars and Chains series number 2 with William Clark. We featured prominently in the first Dollar and Chains series, author of the book Petrodollar Warfare. Let's start off with Clark as he deals with the role that this little cabal network known as the neocons and authors of PNAC, Project of a New American Century. Let's start off with that aspect and how things are playing themselves out. So check this out.
The infamous report in 1992 that basically said, this was at the very end of the Cold War, it was at the very end of George Bush senior administration. It was written by Paul Wolfowitz for then Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney, basically saying that now we have the opportunity, since there is no more Soviet Union, to basically expand our global dominance so that no one can challenge us. And I'll give you a good quote there from that 1992 draft. It says that the United States must show leadership necessary to establish and protect a new order that holds the promise of convincing potential competitors that they need not aspire to a greater role or pursue a more aggressive posture to protect their legitimate interests. We must maintain the mechanisms for deterring potential competitors from even aspiring to a larger regional or global role. So basically, you know, neoconservatives were saying that we are not going to allow anyone to compete with us, militarily, economically, politically. That's basically what this administration is all about. And the euro, obviously, is the one and only competitor to the dollar right now regarding a potential status as world reserve currency. And so this project, New American Century, is full of people such as Donald Rumsfeld and Cheney and Jeb Bush and Paul Wolfowitz and Richard Pearl and those kind of guys that basically have stated for over 10 years now that their goal is to make sure the United States will never allow anyone to compete with us economically or militarily or politically. And they need not even aspire to a larger role, even though they may be acting to protect their legitimate interests. And what's interesting in that 1992 document, actually, it mentions that the United States should reserve the right to act preemptively to control oil.
All right, now, I featured this cat last week, Brzezinski, in the Grand Chessboard, author of the book Grand Chessboard, former U.S. National Security Advisor under the Carter administration. And once again, I'm going to read what he said, a little bit of what he said in the Grand Chessboard, his classic book. Quote, "The Eurasian geostrategy involves the purposeful management of the geostrategically dynamic states and the careful handling of geopolitical catalytic states in keeping with the twin interest of America in the short term preservation of its unique global power and in the long run transformation of it into increasingly institutionalized cooperation. To put it in a terminology that harkens back to the more brutal age of ancient empires, the three grand imperatives of imperial geostrategy are to prevent collusion and maintain security dependence amongst the vassals, to keep tributaries pliant and protected, and to keep the barbarians from coming together." Now, as pointed out last week, this is no different than the neocons document. When he's talking about prevent the collusion and maintain security dependence among the vassals, he's talking about emerging powers like China, emerging entities like, well, the euro dollar, societies that may try to rebuild, like Russia, and any collusion amongst them from organizing or cooperating together, and of course, to protect those who are within the empire fold, like Saudi Arabia. Now, as I went into last week, how this development over this whole petrodollar thing has developed is a situation where the dollar, which became the world currency after the gold standard was abandoned by the Nixon administration, after the dollar was getting stressed out at $35 an ounce because of other countries, industrialized countries that were decimated during World War II, being retooled and back on the market because of the economic draining effect of the Vietnam War, and people seeing throughout the world screaming about the inflationary and devaluation of the U.S. dollar and wanting to basically turn in their dollars for gold, and the U.S. not having enough gold to supplement that, and wasn't about to do it anyway. Nixon just abandoned the gold standard. At that point, they had secret meetings with their greatest central ally, Saudi Arabia, and set up the petrodollar system, where now petroleum had to be bought with U.S. dollars, which set up the next phase of the American century. So you had basically the first phase of the American century come out of the ashes of World War II in 1945, when the Bretton Woods Conference was set up and the U.S. dollar was used as a world currency based off of a gold standard. But starting in the early 70s, it transformed into a black gold standard, petroleum. The U.S. had OPEC then, which was now within its wing because OPEC basically followed Saudi Arabia's lead. They manufactured the 400% spike, it's called the oil shocks, in the 70s, because now the dollar was tied to petroleum. Now this had global implications. It's been the seed and a cornerstone of underdevelopment and third world debt, but it stabilized, quote unquote, the dollar, even though it has played a pivotal role in unstabilizing the planet and setting us up for the next stage that we're in, where the euro has emerged, starting in January of 1999. And the euro dollar now poses a threat to U.S., to the U.S. greenback and its dollar dominance on a global scale. Now, oil being the crucial energy source at this time, because people are locked in a petroleum world system, the industrialized nation and the privatized order and all of that, you have a system that, a situation where these privatized advisors and administrators for the empire know this. And so they're not thinking about or concerned about developing a sustainable world. And they know that maintaining what Brzezinski was talking about, protection more or less, for the societies that are within the sphere of U.S. global participation, crucial to the U.S. global dollarism and petrodollar warfare mechanism, dollar imperialism, dollar militarism, like Saudi Arabia, how they must be protected, and how that region of the world must be in Sam's grips. 65% of the petroleum produced on the planet at this present time comes out of the Middle East. January 23rd, 1980, the then President Jimmy Carter announced his Carter Doctrine. Carter said this, quote, "Let our position be absolutely clear. An attempt by any outside force to gain control of the Persian Gulf region will be regarded as an assault on the vital interests of the United States of America, and such an assault will be repelled by any means necessary, including military force," unquote. What Carter is basically saying is the exact thing, same thing that Brzezinski, his advisor, who in part wrote that for Carter, because they were on the same page, who was his security advisor at the time, about anyone challenging U.S. hegemony, or in Brzezinski's own words in the Grand Chessboard, to put it in the terminology that harkens back to the more brutal age of ancient empires, the three grand imperatives of imperial geostrategy are to prevent the collusion and maintain security dependence among the vassals, to keep tributaries pliant and protected, and to keep the barbarians from coming together. This is no different, fundamentally, from the neocon outline. But now you have a situation where it's become more intensified with the rise of the euro and other developments. These cats have always aligned themselves this way. They've always had their eyes focused in on energy because they know it's crucial. Energy sources are crucial for empires. This is why Roosevelt, when he was informed about the peak oil coming up in America, because at the time, the United States used to be the Saudi Arabia of the world. It used to be the main producer of petroleum. And it was the leader of feeding the world of petroleum. But their own reports came out about America hitting its peak. That's when Roosevelt met with the king of Saudi Arabia back in the day and set up their agreement starting back then. And the fact that the king of Saudi Arabia had slaves with him didn't matter. Because for all these privatizers, this ain't about human morality, cooperation. This is about dominance. And they mean to dominate. Roosevelt, quote, "I hereby find that the defense of Saudi Arabia is vital to the defense of the United States," unquote. Now, this is very similar to the type of thing that, yeah, you hear these neocons say about Israel. So, these guys know where their particular geopolitical interests are locked into. There is no Israel without Saudi Arabia because of the way the geopolitical petrodollar petrol system is set up within the privatized order and how dollar imperialism and dominance hegemony for the U.S. empire is maintained in part off of the U.S. cooperation and collaboration with Saudi Arabia. Now next, let's check out with what F. William Indell, author of the book A Century of War, has to say about the Pentagon's term of full spectrum dominance in this post-Cold War. So check this out.
Full spectrum dominance, the Pentagon term, one of the lovely expressions that they like to throw out to obfuscate what they're doing. But I think if we step back a little bit and look at what the end of the Cold War was all about, in historical perspective, we basically had a huge chunk of this planet that suddenly, after about 70 years, and certainly after 1945, was open for the first time to Western banking, Western capital relations, if you want to call it that. And basically the message of, well, George Bush Sr. at that time was president in the Houston, Texas G7 Economic Summit was in 1990, in June of 1990, he basically told the other members of the Group of Seven, the French, the Germans, the Italians, and so forth, that the International Monetary Fund was going to call the shots in terms of restructuring the former Soviet economy. Now, that's very calculated on the part of Washington, because what they did was to apply an economic shock therapy that told the Russians essentially overnight, from day one to day two, you have to become a quote market economy. What that meant was not just a plundering of the assets of this huge land, Russia, the largest land expanse of any country in the world, but access to the raw materials in dollar terms was what emerged, and that was the whole purpose of the Clinton Russian policy, to get the to get their hands on the oil and gas assets, as well as the aluminum and the other magnesium and the other commodities that Russia is so rich in. So the end of the Cold War was really the opening of a whole part of this world to rather crude, I don't know a better word for it, exploitation by certain Western companies that took what they could at bargain basement prices.
Yes, it's just that cold. This is what this is all about. And you have a situation where, of course, the imperialists, as Indahl was talking about, saw that with the collapse of the Soviets, this region being opened up to Western banks, and now being involved within it, within a particular sphere of capital relationships, forced them through a form of shock therapy, which is common that you see like throughout the Third World. You know, they call it various forms of structural adjustment, austerity programs, etc. And that now Sam was going to have ruthlessly raw access to Russia's material in dollar terms. Aluminum, magnesium, etc., etc. And this was part of Crime Bill Clinton's policy. Now, these whole dynamics are basically forms of raw, naked capitalist plundering. And it's helped set the stage for resistance. Now, when it happens by states, of course, it's resistance in their own type of militarized, privatized forms and stuff. We're not talking about resistance in some kind of transformative way of crushing imperial systems as they develop within the world sphere of dollar and chains marketized societies. No, it's just basically trying to maneuver oneself into a position so that they are not so easily manipulated, but in the process become involved in a lot of imperial geopolitical strategies themselves, as we've seen with places like Russia and China, as it's playing out in regions like Africa, the Sudan, etc., etc. So here we have a situation where the expansion markers are basically forms of imperial development and restructuring in the spectrum of the U.S. imperial sphere. And the dollar system and interests is a key part of that. So you just have the constant aspect of crushing societies and expanding on them as much as possible, creating world societies being more and more unstable. Now, this whole dollar militarism, as it's playing itself out, is what Indahl goes into next. As the dollar as the world currency and its super military is second pillar of U.S. hegemony, the dollar, the petrodollar system, is in the U.S. dollar's world dominance as the world currency is one of the great pillars of its imperial mechanism. Its military is its second. Let's go into this whole aspect with Indahl on this aspect of its military domination in this super imperialism game, where another aspect of its technology is divide and conquer in this grand chessboard. Dig.
The basic premise on which the American hegemony has been built in the post-war period is the dollar as reserve currency. That covers a multitude of sins, and the role of the U.S. as the unchallenged military superpower on this planet. Now, the military role in recent years has dominated over the economic role, I think especially since the European Union, back at the end of the 90s, launched their euro single currency, and for the first time in the post-war period, actually presented a theoretical potential challenge to the hegemony of the U.S. dollar as reserve currency. To date, the Europeans haven't gotten their act together. The United States, Washington has played on that in a classic balance of power, divide and conquer strategy by trying to pit the British against the French, the Poles against the Germans, the Spanish, and so forth, especially around the Iraq War. But the Europeans haven't gotten a coherent strategy to counter the throw weight of the U.S. military force projection globally, and the role of the dollar as reserve currency remains. The question really is how long countries such as China and, well, Japan is a special case because of the post-war military defense relation between Washington and Tokyo. But leaving Japan aside, how long will China accumulate dollar reserves and look at their investment simply propping up the U.S. indebtedness and the U.S. oil wars in the Middle East that are, or theoretically, actually taking future oil reserves from the Chinese economy? So that's an open question, and I can't give you a specific date, but I think it's a highly precarious geopolitical situation that Washington has developed for itself in the last 10, 15 years.
So here you have a situation, as I went into in the first series of Dollars and Chains, the U.S. is, when it had the world locked into a petrodollar system, where you had other societies have to gain access to the dollar in, for it to be able to buy the crucial energy source called petroleum, the U.S., being the imperial predatory society that it is, of course, would intentionally overspend, go in debt, knowing that these countries being locked into a situation where they were now in a situation where they had to help preserve the dollar because it was a petroleum exchange currency, would invest and put all of their money into treasury, the bonds, U.S. treasury bonds, etc., etc. So for years you've had the U.S. population and government basically be in incredible debt, but be able to force the rest of the world to eat its debt. So it became a way of the U.S. empire disciplining and further underdeveloping other societies at its own expense. Now, with the rise of the euro and Saddam, who stomped out of that meeting in September of 2000, and saying that he was going to go euro, that all of his exchange in the oil for food program was now going to be in euro. So if you wanted to buy his petroleum, and he was pushing out 3.3 million barrels a day, you would have to buy it in euro dollars. So basically it was a war on the U.S. dollar. Sam was getting 60% of that 3.3 million barrels of petroleum a day. And Sam was forced to buy it in euros. Now, at first, when Saddam did this thing, it was kind of laughed at because the euro was depreciated below the U.S. dollar. But the effects of the vulgarity and the recklessness of the U.S. society was starting to really grip the U.S. dollar. The dot-com bubble bust, all this Enron madness, scandals, WorldCom, etc., etc. So the dollar itself was becoming more and more destabilized. So you had a situation where the dollar depreciated and the euro kept on rising. So the euro dollar, by the time Sam stomped in to Iraq in 2003, the euro dollar was 17% appreciated above the US dollar. So Saddam was getting more bang from the buck by going euro. He made out like a bandit, then sticking with the dollar. Of course, the whole world was watching this. And now with this alternative currency, it put a whole nother spectrum into play. This is what Sam is very acute to, because if more and more societies keep turning away from the US dollar and dumping the dollar, a key pillar of US dominance, which is its dollar system, this is its main export. It's not goods and services, it's the dollar. And the next thing is its military and military hardware. But if that fades, then the U.S. empire crumbles, and they know it. So this outlines the next phase that we're in with the launch of the euro. Represents the third phase of the American century, and it's a phase that the imperialists in America plan on maneuvering through by any and all means, as Carter himself said. Now, while we have various, you know, knuckleheads on Sam's plantation talk about what we need is a regime change, in other words, replace a raggedy Republican with a raggedy Democrat, so that you'll basically have a Democrat be an administrator for this ruling order and dollar imperialism, petrodollar orthodoxy that we have, or that we need to be saved from the neocon, or we need some spiritual development. In other words, the left needs to bend its knees and head into the feces of Jesus or Muhammad or Moses or whatever, the Dalai Lama, and all this other nonsense. The battles here with within the U.S. empire and by the proponents of those within the sphere of the U.S. empire, it's going full throttle ahead regardless, as we know. As now the situation and developments keep intensifying, where you have Japan, who has been within the sphere of America in certain trade and things like that, finds itself increasingly having more and more trade with China. And this is also playing a role in a change of the balance of power and influence. Let's check this out.
The number one question in the behind the doors in the planning rooms of the Pentagon and the planning rooms of the State Department, in the White House and elsewhere, this is really emergence of China as a strategic counterweight to the not only the economic power, but the political power of the United States. And the Chinese have been very, very shrewd and I'd say rather cautious since the Iraq War in 2003 in how they have played their cards vis-a-vis the relationship with Washington. But I think if you look at the kind of thing that I described in the book, In the Century of War, about the emergence of the United States around the time between World War One and World War Two, the end of 1945, as the dominant superpower, the hegemonic power on this planet, assuming the role that the British Empire had played for a century since the end of the Napoleonic Wars in the early 1800s, that was an epochal change. That was a profound phase change in world geopolitics. And I think we are coming into precisely that kind of epochal change or phase change in global geopolitics. In fact, we're right now, and that is the emergence of China-centered Asia. The role that Japan plays vis-a-vis China, I think, is an open question still. I think the Chinese elites are split on that. The business elites are very, very, as you pointed out, are very locked into dependence on Chinese low-cost labor and production processes. So it's becoming for Japan a very complicated thing to balance their Washington relation along with their growing involvement with China economically.
So as you can see, the emergence of China is of a crucial issue in the halls of power, because they see this as what Brzezinski talked about, what the corridors and administrators for the rulers, like the neocons, talked about. It's a threat from the aspect of what Carter talked about, because as China's economy and industrialized society keeps expanding, it requires more and more of this vital resource as the privatized systems are set up. They're not thinking about, on a serious level, about alternative energies that we could easily go into and that are really there for the taking and development. But they're locked into this geopolitical grand chessboard strategy game. And for that reason, with China now moving into the second place as world consumer of petroleum, and its incredible development that's taking place, and its mobility to transfer its dollars, its U.S. dollars, into alternative monetary systems, these all play a very crucial role and a scary role to those in power within the sphere of the U.S. empire. So now you have a situation where they are investing incredible amounts of energy and time in trying to lock China into a dependency for access of access to these energy based societies. Because if they can lock China into a situation where it doesn't have its own markets, you know, within places like Iran, throughout Africa and stuff like that, it'll still be dependent regardless of how fast its economy is expanding. So these are the geostrategic moves that Brzezinski and others, of course, have talked about, and these are what are actually taking place. These guys are doing maneuverings, and one of the key regions that China has its eyes on is Iran. And this is one of the regions where it's making a lot of deals and contracts. So this plays into how Sam, of course, is going to try to label Iran because of the geopolitical strategic implications that this can have. and are happy. Now, next, Indel explores Sam's imperial military power projections on this grand chessboard. Check this out.
The military power projection of the United States, if you look at the, well, just look at the post-war period alone, the whole role of U.S. force projection in the Middle East has to do with one country in particular, that is Saudi Arabia, the largest oil producer until today, with Russia giving it a good run for its money, but Saudi Arabia still remains the largest producer, although there's very serious doubt as to whether the Saudis are giving honest numbers on their production these days. Perhaps we can talk about that later. What's quite fascinating to me, looking at the geopolitics of U.S. policy since the end of the Cold War, is U.S. military power projection in what people like Zbigniew Brzezinski and strategists in Washington call Eurasia. Eurasia is simply Europe and Asia as a landmass. If you simply look at a globe or look at a map of the globe, you see that it's one contiguous landmass from China across Russia into Western Europe. And that's called Eurasia by geographers. The British, back in since 1904, have been very much focused on the control of Eurasia through British naval policy up until 1945, when the British essentially emerged as a bankrupt empire to be bought out on the cheap by Washington, by the U.S. Look at the various military engagements that the U.S. has had since the end of the Cold War, and in almost every single one of them, the dollar and oil play a strategic role. Afghanistan, the whole pipeline politics for oil and natural gas going through Afghanistan, down into India and various other places. The role of the United States in the Kosovo War in 1999, the Clinton administration, the first NATO out-of-area deployment, actually a violation of the NATO charter, but those legal niceties are often these days simply ignored and wasted in the history. The Kosovo deployment allowed the United States to build something called Camp Bondsteel. And Camp Bondsteel is a state-of-the-art, one of the largest military fortresses that the United States has in the world today. That allows the United States to position itself such that it can control potential pipeline flows coming from Russia, coming from the Black Sea, and so forth, into Western Europe or into various ports that would bring it out onto the world market. I think the basic driver of U.S. foreign policy in recent years has been to militarily position itself to control essentially every single major source of petroleum that is known to exist on the planet. And that, in addition to that, to control the major oil choke points. You know, you have these channels like the Straits of Hormuz, you have the Straits of Malacca going through the narrow passageway between Indonesia and Burma, or today it's called Myanmar. That brings most of the crude oil tanker flows from the Persian Gulf around into China and Japan. So the United States has been doing little pinprick actions to try to position itself in that part of the world militarily. So far it hasn't succeeded. The Chinese and the East Asians, the Southeast Asian countries have been very adamant, Malaysia especially, about not having U.S. naval presence in that area for obvious reasons. But if you look at the politics in Iraq, this catastrophic situation from the standpoint of U.S. policy, in Iraq it's just been announced that there are four major permanent military bases, U.S. bases, that are being completed in Iraq, and while there may be public talk about a few soldiers going home, the U.S. is creating like a Guantanamo, but Mach 4 Guantanamo, four huge bases in Iraq for permanent military presence. Another recent innovation has been creation of an air base in Principe and San Tome, which are islands just off of the oil-rich regions of Angola and West Africa. So the U.S. military very much not just follows the flag, it follows the oil these days in American foreign policy.
So here we have a situation that for all imperial societies that are based in a privatized construct, for them to maintain and expand their dominance, which is what imperial privatized societies do, a key component of that is controlling resources and maintaining other societies locked within your particular sphere of influence, like your currency. That's the aspect of dollar imperialism. And that tied with the aspect of the petrodollar scheme outlines the aspect of a key component for U.S. imperialism and how essential that is for those who are a part of that whole mechanism to maintain other societies throughout the world under its boot. Now, as Endel pointed out, all of these bases, all of these particular strategic outlines that Sam has, the Afghan issue with the oil and natural gas, Kosovo, and that whole setup where you have the Camp Bondsteel, the largest military fortress, and how that positions the U.S. empire to be able to be in control of any kind of pipeline flow from Russia through the Black Sea, etc., etc. Now, these are all the things that these other societies know and are strategically trying to strategize their way around to try to loosen the dollar chain grip and geopolitical energy resource grip, which, of course, the dollar is tied into, that Sam has on it. And they know. All you have to do is look at the third world, places like Africa, where the mentality basically is, when our dollar petrol system causes your societies to collapse, eat grass, niggas. That's basically the attitude. We have a situation where many of these societies, when the oil rents went up 400% after the U.S. and Saudi Arabia strategized them up in the oil shocks of 73 and 74, of course, many of these third world societies, many of whom were just trying to get over the shackles of the traditional forms of colonialization, found themselves in a situation where, of course, they couldn't afford these catastrophically high prices. The U.S. then had incredible influence and was able to manipulate and reconstruct these societies into producing the particular goods that they wanted. So you could have a situation where you could be in a particular society where you're told to produce all this coffee for, you know, Sam's plantation drinkers. Now, you may need to grow food for your own people, but hey, if you want petroleum or access to petroleum, you have to sell what Sam wants in order to get access to his dollars. And he could easily manipulate through other slaves he has on this global plantation to crush their prices down in Latin America or whatever, so you could end up competing against them. The prices could collapse. And now, since that's how you rearrange your agricultural society at the boot of Sam to get access to money, to then U.S. dollars, to get petroleum, and to also now to feed your population, because he's destroyed your agricultural base in order to get U.S. dollars. So Now you have to buy food out in the market that you used to grow in your own society. But since your need for the dollar, because you're locked in within that system, overrode that, and you were told, no, just sell what Sam wants in order to get access to the dollar, and then you could buy this food that you've been growing for thousands of years on your own. Well, this is in part how you have these collapses and starvations that you see, because of the way Sam has locked societies in to this petrodollar scheme. And within the corridors of power, he doesn't blink an eye at what he's creating. He stomps straight ahead. So within that sphere, if you're over there in China and you see ruthlessly what he's done, if you just got through some of the raping in Russia that you've seen Sam do, then of course, within the way these hierarchical societies are operating and functioning, it's not shocking that you see them now playing themselves out in this geostrategic game, in a maneuvering mechanism. Now here, Indel gives some background on a previous super empire and the pillars that this British Empire rested on, and how some of these wars were based off of them. Check it out.
British Empire was extraordinarily successful in the period up until about the end of the 1800s, the 1890s, I would say. They had a run of almost a century, and they dominated. They were rather cocky about it toward the end, toward the outbreak of World War I. The expression was, the sun never sets on the British Empire. In reality, what was happening was that the pillars of the British Empire were beginning to rot out from under them. The finance, the City of London finance and the gold standard was simply not able to extract the rates of profit from places like Argentina, where they had a huge bankruptcy that Barings Bank was involved in the 1890s. England went through a Great Depression. It's something that most people today don't even realize, but they went through from 1873 to 1890, they went through a deep economic depression because of their economic strategy at that point. So coming into the First World War, what was called then the Great War, the financial pillar of the City of London was extremely shaky, although no one talked about it publicly. I researched in preparing the book, I researched certain archival documents from the British Finance Ministry that have since been released into the public domain. And they basically show that the British government was bankrupt on the eve of World War I, 1914. The raw materials, well, there the British were very foresighted. Winston Churchill, as a young naval man at that time, and Jack Fisher, the Lord of the Admiralty, they were foresighted enough to realize that oil was the energy source that would create a revolution in transportation, in the reach of a navy, and so forth. The first navy to convert into oil-fired ships would have a strategic advantage unparalleled. So British geopolitics began, at the turn of the century, began orienting itself on control of world-known oil regions. Well, in the United States, you had John D. Rockefeller and the Standard Oil Trust, which was at the same time beginning to poke its head out of the United States and look around the world for just the same thing, how Standard Oil could control the world's oil resources. So the raw materials, World War I was very much about busting up the old Ottoman Empire, the Ottoman Reich, and dismantling it in order that the British could take the richest oil lands in Persia, Iran today, in Iraq, then called Mesopotamia, in Kuwait, which the British essentially swindled out from under the Ottoman Reich in 1899 with a 100-year agreement that nobody would do business with Kuwait except the British. That was rather a cute thing. So they began to try to secure the raw materials of the future, but the problem for the British was that the financial pillar was really crumbling out from under them. And in a sense, what you can see is the period between 1914, let's say, and 1945 was an unresolved struggle over who would be the successor empire or the successor hegemon, the successor power, global power, to the crumbling British Empire. And there were two contenders at the turn of the century in 1900 or so. The one was the enormous industrial expansion of Germany on the continent. Germany had an education system unparalleled in the world at that time. They had an industrial steel industry, chemical industry. I mean, the patents, the inventions, they were coming out of Germany like no other place. And the British were astonished by this. They had not expected such a colossal growth. This is in certain ways similar perhaps to the rapid expansion of China on the economic front in the last 10 years. But the United States saw this very much as well, and the United States Washington policy, or the policy of the, let's call it the New York establishment or the East Coast establishment, which essentially in that time boiled down to the oil interest and the New York banks such as National City, such as Chase Bank of the Rockefeller Group and so forth, J.P. Morgan, of course, they said we have a chance to get in on the game of empire here by becoming the banker to the bankrupt British. They financed all the British military expenses during World War One. At the end of the war, they said, excuse me, Britain, you've got to pay back your debts here. So that was the beginning of a struggle which took until 1945 to resolve itself, and that was what Henry Luce called the American century, the emergence of the American colossus, of the American hegemony. That now is, to my mind, on equally shaky legs as the British were in 1914.
So once again, you get an outline of the dynamics and power play that really are going on. And see, these imperialists, they know it. They know how shaky, as I tried to make clear in the whole Dollar and Chains One, make clear on how shaky and how crucial it is to the imperialists to now use its second great pillar of its hegemonic power, its military, to maintain its dominance and maintain the dollar's dominance in the global sphere. And it's not really that much different than the crisis that the British had found themselves in, as Indell was pointing out, as their pillars were beginning to rot out. The financial gold standard structure was crumbling in the 1890s, that England was slipping into its Great Depression, and they started to expand their military muscle, and they started to go after even more ruthlessly the raw materials, and they saw petroleum as being one of the revolutionary developments in transportation and in military, for that matter, coming up at the turn of the century. But they lacked the financing, so you had other players, and in this case they were part of the network of the U.S. empire, not the United States at the time. They weren't an empire at the time, just a ruthless barbaric nation. But they saw themselves strategically maneuvering for their own particular interest on that grand chessboard. So you had that particular situation playing itself out for their particular interest and stuff. And as those developments took place, you had a situation where the British were becoming more and more in debt to the U.S. Now, the U.S. was in serious trouble, more trouble than most people know, in the 1970s when its own gold standard crisis hit. When Nixon abandoned it and was able to work with their great ally, Saudi Arabia, into locking the world into this petroleum dollar scheme, that set a whole new lease of life to the U.S. empire and harkened in another whole dark age of U.S. imperial dominance. But as I've been mentioning, and as others that I've been clicking into have been alluding to and talking about, this rise of the euro, this alternative, I shouldn't say alternative, was an alternative privatized monetary system. It's not a true alternative for humanity, but it's an alternative privatized monetary system has now entered into play. This has created even more tension and dynamics and problems for the U.S. pillar of influence as its dollar is rotting out, similar to the British dollar rotting out back in the day. Now, let's go into this some more concerning this whole British Empire dynamic to show some of how these things had historically played out and some of the similarities of how they're playing out today and how this is how empires operate. It's not about particular administrators, you know, quote unquote, acting out. They act out and they're fools and barbarians, but it's not some abnormality considering the fact that they are players within a sick and insidious system. So on the eve of World War I, the British Empire was basically bankrupt. And they basically pulled out their military machine. Just like the U.S. Empire is trillions of dollars in debt on a public and private scale. And, well, we're seeing those machine guns rocking. Let's deal with this from the aspect of the British aspect in World War I and its adventure into the war on the eve of its own bankruptcy.
The British Treasury was essentially unable to finance a war. It was simply, there was a confidential memo sent to the Prime Minister at the outbreak of war that essentially they were bankrupt. So, and as I pointed out, J.P. Morgan was the one who filled the gap and did so with a very calculated intent, and that was that Washington would dictate the terms of the post-war Versailles so-called peace negotiations and play a role in carving up Europe and the rest of the world. Well, the British weren't quite willing to step down from the center stage at that point, so there was a very, very bitter kind of hidden war that went on over the size of naval fleets, and it almost, according to some British friends of mine, it almost came to a shooting war between Washington and Britain in the 1920s. The role of oil, it was one of the diagrams I have in the book, is something that I found from a magazine called the London Petroleum Review, and this was in May of 1914, the London Petroleum Review, and they show a picture of the route of a German rail project that today is almost unknown, even in Germany. It was called at that time the Berlin-Baghdad Railway. Very interesting in light of the history of Iraq up to the present. And the German idea was to build a railway from Berlin, i.e. the heart of continental Europe, to link through trade, to link all the way down to Baghdad and ultimately down to the Arabian Gulf or the Persian Gulf, that could then bring trade from India or the Indian subcontinent up through by land connection direct into continental Europe. Now, that was a strategic threat to the power of the Royal Navy, the British military control of the water and the Suez Canal, because the Germans essentially were outflanking by going by land over the Balkans and into Turkey and down through into Baghdad, and the rail line was already finished. Well, the London Petroleum Review in May of 1914 has a picture of a petroleum map of Mesopotamia, and they show that the great oil fields of Kirkuk, the great oil fields of Mosul, and so forth, that today are the site of so much contention, they were already well known at that time to be huge reserves of petroleum. So that was extremely provocative to the British, that the continental Europeans would try to become potentially economic independent from the British Imperial Navy.
All right, so when you hear this, it helps outline how basically the British, with this Royal Imperial Navy, it's considering what the Germans were strategizing, it's Berlin to Baghdad railway, which would go through the whole Arabian Gulf, through the Indian subcontinent, you know, to Europe, continental Europe, basically a Eurasian-type strategy that would outflank the control that the British had in the waterways because of its great navy military apparatus. They considered that what provocative. Why? Because the Germans were doing something that would allow them independence, economic and raw material independence. So in other words, this can't be tolerated. Now, when you put that into context of how these people operate, how these how the machine operates when it sees that its hegemony is being a challenge that way, and the British Empire at, you know, back in the day before its crisis really started to rip it apart, its pillars of hegemonic power was its worldwide banking institutions, its control of the sea, and its domination of raw materials. In other words, it's basically how dollar imperialism in the current situation for the U.S. is based on. Only the U.S. is integrated the raw material, especially petroleum, into the dollar itself, a petroleum dollar exchange system that has the world under as much as possible its hooves. Now, the reason why I mention this aspect in detail and go over this aspect of what the British and their response and how they thought of that, basically, them considering what the Germans do being provocative because they're trying to be economically and raw materially independent of them, is basically a British neocon type of mentality, or a British Jimmy Carter Carter doctrine, or a British Brzezinski grand chessboard declaration. In other words, their response was not any different in reality than the response advocated and carried out by previous administrators for the order in America. Whether we're talking about Carter, Roosevelt, the neocons, Brzezinski, or whoever. because they understand that maintaining their global dominance is in part tied to control over energy sources and the banking institutions, the dollar imperial institutions that these societies are based in. So currency warfare is tied within all of that. Now, as the dollar, or as British currency was basically imploding and they were going bankrupt, more countries stretching out on their own independent streak was considered more and more provocative to the British and was propelling them to use their military might in a more and more violent way. Now, in this current setting, you've seen a situation where as societies have started to diversify out of the U.S. dollar hegemony system, as you've seen Saddam basically in September of 2000, as I mentioned before, September 24th to be exact, come out of a meeting and say that his government would transition its oil export out of the U.S. dollar to the euro, which had been part of the foundation of U.S. Currency imperial dominance since the 70s when it was set up with Nixon and the Saudis. This had ramifications and forms of economic independence that, like the British, the U.S. empire was not going to tolerate. Now, when you have elites that since the 1945 be set up a gold standard that served their purpose for dominance, that gold standard basically go to 1971. And then from 71 to 99, we can more or less call it the petroleum, the petrodollar standard, which was the second phase of the American century. And then with the advent of the petrodollar in 99, this new stage, which is basically now a warfare stage to maintain U.S. dollar dominance, then one can see how dire the world societies are finding themselves in. Now, let's go into how, like the U.S., that had its peak oil production hit in the 1970s, and the Soviets, who had their peak production of petroleum hit in the 1980s, and we've seen a steady decline of the peak of production of Russia's oil fields since that period in 1987 when it hit its peak. It was calculated to be in 1983 by the CIA, but it actually hit in 1987. Other major regions throughout the world also seem to be nearing at least their peak. While Sam continues to scream full spectrum dominance,
say openly, why beat around the bush? America is an empire, and we should be proud of it and boast of it, and the rest of the world can take it on the ear if they don't like it. That kind of arrogance is not only damaging, but it's the height of folly. Whom the gods would make mad, they first destroy, is
the old Greek saying. But this question of the peaking of oil, I think if you look around to the major oil sources worldwide in the last 40, 50 years, you have in Alaska, the Prudhoe Bay has peaked some years now, and it's on its depletion downslide of the bell-shaped curve, the famous King Hubbard bell-shaped curve, the peak of the optimal production. The North Sea has peaked. This has become something in the year 2000, the British North Sea peaked, and now the rate of that decline has begun accelerating in a dramatic way, such that the British are finally waking up. The British government openly is talking about a post-petroleum era for Britain. Well, for 35 years since the beginning of the 70s, well, actually since 1973 and the first oil shock when North Sea oil became financially attractive at a higher oil price, Britain has lived off of the sterling, has been a petrol currency. Well, that era is gone. The big fields like Brent, you know, Brent is one of the markers, ironically, of crude oil prices today. Well, it shouldn't be, because the Brent field is down to something, last time I looked, around 10,000 barrels a day. It's a disappearing field, which has been relegated to tiny independent companies because big companies no longer find it economical. Matthew Simmons speculates based on all the best information he's able to glean from petroleum sources in and around Saudi Arabia, is that the Ghawar field, the giant, the mother of all oil production fields, with something like 5.5, almost 6 million barrels a day. That is the big question. And Simmons and some other people and some geologists, Colin Campbell from Scotland, called the Saudis bluff. When was it? About a year or two ago in the summer. And the Saudis rushed people over to Washington to hold a press conference and vehemently deny, with very shaky data,
their oil had in fact peaked. But I think all the indication of the water injection into Ghawar, millions of barrels of salt water a day, indicates that they are in a desperate situation there. So Saudi, the major fields, the condition in the Russian oil fields, as best anyone can tell, and the geologist that I've spoken with from the Western European oil men who've been to Russia, is that they are dangerously overproducing most of their big oil fields in Russia to get the maximum currency. You know, dollar flows into the economy after 1998. And unless they get some huge new investment and infrastructure built up there, they're gonna be in trouble in terms of maintaining the oil flows in 2 to 3 years. And even the Russian press talks about this danger. So if you take that and compare that to the demand side of the equation, you have this enormous, 800-pound oil gorilla, or I don't know what an appropriate term is. That's probably not the best term to refer to China, but China has gone from a zero factor of demand on the international oil import markets 10 years ago, 1994. China was a net exporter of oil. Last year, China became the second largest importer behind the United States. It surpassed Japan of crude oil, and over the next few years, the demand of Asia for oil is expected to double to 40 million barrels a day. So that you have this huge exponential demand curve going coming out of Asian economic growth. The Chinese, of course, are scrambling all over the world right now to get secure energy pipelines or energy resources for its future economic growth, because that they realize is their Achilles heel. And the United States is moving just as quickly to cut them off from that oil. So this I think, is the number one hidden geopolitical game in the world today, this contest for oil control between China and Washington.
So you can see the dynamic that's taking place on a serious scale. And when you have societies that are armed up to the teeth, now, of course, China's not as armed as Sam is, but China finds itself in more and more collaboration with other societies, specifically this Russia, who is armed quite quite a lot. And Iran, you can see the dynamics of developments that could easily spiral out of control. Now, while all of these areas are reaching their peak, and it's not like these things are infinite. As I've mentioned before, these are just dead energy systems. That's why they call them fossil fuel. And they're a finite resource. Now, here you have a situation where there are other resources, and things come out about these particular resources, but in the world of privatized control and manipulation, they don't get the air volume, so to speak, that civilized world development would embrace these issues in, if there was really civilizing going on the planet. Now, an article came out in the Energy Bulletin called Wind Farms Can Meet Energy Needs. And it goes like this. Wind power could generate more than enough sustainable electricity to meet global energy needs, according to new research. Scientists at Stanford University have produced a world map that plots wind power potential for the first time. They say that harnessing even 20% of that energy would produce 8 times more electricity than the world consumed in 2000. Quote, the main implications of this study is that wind, for low-cost wind energy, is more widely available than previously recognized, unquote, said Christina Archer, formerly of Stanford's Department of Civil and Environmental Engineer. Archer and colleague Mark Jacobson collected wind speed measurements from 7,500 surface stations and 500 balloon launch stations to determine wind speed at 80 meters, which is 300 feet, the height of modern turbines. They found average wind speeds capable of generating power upwards of 6.9 meters per second, or 15 miles an hour, in 13% of the stations and in all regions of the globe. North America had the greatest potential for wind energy, with consistent winds found in the Great Lakes region and along both the northeastern and northwestern coast. Now, I can go on and on about this, but Jacobson has written articles that have appeared in scientific review magazines and on. But see, this is about global domination. So here, alternative energy systems that are in full scale, that could be in full scale development and operation, is not how these privatized orders strategize themselves out, because they're not interested in a cooperative society. They're interested in global domination, and that's the peril that we find ourselves more and more in. You have another article that was out by Amante Real, and this was called Argentine Town Hopes to Transform Wind into Windfall. And it goes how into Argentina for the past 36 years, the 8 steps from Alberto Ibanez barbershop to the sidewalk have marked the precise distance between the designs of man and the whims of nature. Quote, even if you put grease in your hair, the wind still messes it up, Ibanez said. And the wind is very dry, so there's a lot of static electricity. Usually people just get their hair cut short, unquote. Like the airborne dust that collects in the seams of their clothes, such concessions are ingrained in the lives of every inhabitant of this Patagonian town of 15,000, which sprang up 90 years ago to service a now abandoned railroad line. But today, Pico Chucanto is trying to turn its win into a windfall. The town gets more than half of its electricity from four windmills, two of which began operating 3 weeks ago. And it goes on and on and on. You get the point of where I'm heading. See, here you have what is not a finite resource, which is a living resource. But see, these privatized orders are basically dead energy systems themselves. So of course, quite naturally, they're going to try to maintain us locked into a path that has only deadly consequences. Here, Indell wraps it up, explaining what kind of period the world is in this history, in time, and where he thinks we possibly may be headed.
To say I just take each day as it comes. There's so many potential ways that the situation could develop. I think we're coming into the most dangerous period in world history, bar none, simply because the scale-up effect of total spectrum dominance, the Pentagon's force projection, is such that it threatens biological holocaust, it threatens nuclear holocaust, it threatens chemical catastrophe and every which thing you can imagine. So, the stakes of serious mistakes are greater than they ever were before. But it's also a period where great surprises can take place. So I would hope for the latter, and let's pray that it works out, that we see that.
Got to do more than just praying, because these savages are headed on a deadly course. You know, some of the stuff that's been going on in Iran, you can see the developments and a strategic type character that's making things more and more serious. Because, as Iran basically is developing what you can call at the Natanz faculty, part of the what's called the front end or the fuel preparation cycle for its whole nuclear facilities, and they have ore and other things that are first milled and developed basically into yellowcake. They can then convert that into uranium hetrafluoride, which is basically a gas, and all these other developments. It has a number of properties that make it self-sufficient, and at its various facilities, like the Arak facility, which produces heavy water and so on and so forth, they are in a position to develop even more deeply their nuclear reactors and stuff. It basically needs four of them. And the U.S. is basically using this as an excuse. And part of this excuse has to do with some of the other players that are making geopolitical connections with Iran at the time. You had a situation where recently China has made various deals with Iran, and these factors have tied closer relationships with the Iranian government. And one of them was a huge oil and gas deal that they set up with them. And they have the potential of $70 billion to possibly $100 billion of, you know, funds coming out of this whole thing. And the Iran oil minister stated beforehand that, quote, Japan is our number one energy importer for historical reasons, but we would like to give preference to exports to China. And in return, China is becoming a major exporter of manufactured goods to Iran. Now, these types of developments are just what China is going after, because they're all trying to maneuver themselves from being locked into this Eurasian, which is basically Europe and Asia together, all one major landmass, from being locked into the grips that Sam is trying to lock them into. So Russia's into play within this whole spectrum. And Russia has recently, in March of 2005, signed an agreement for selling to Iran $7 billion worth of future defense contracts, which are basically defensive missiles, quote-unquote, defensive missiles. And during that time, Moscow has been involved with Iran to build 5 to 7 additional nuclear power reactors. And they plan in this whole particular deal to get $10 billion within a contract, along with the additional arms sales to Iran. So within these types of dynamics, Iran is locking closer and closer alignments with Russia, closer and closer alignments with China. China has incredible amounts of money in its treasury, in U.S. treasury, to maintain the U.S. dollar. But at the same time, the euro currency is appreciated above the U.S. dollar. China is finding itself being able to strategically maneuver itself into deals with other societies that further loosen the grip in this grand chessboard that Sam is trying to lock itself into, as we went in before about all the bases that Sam has set up and how it's trying to lock in particular corridors and access, etc., etc., and how these things are strategically and politically playing themselves out. Now, what's also interesting, as these things develop, Putin announced that it was no that Russia was no longer going to abide by a secret U.S.-Russian agreement to ban Russian weapon sales to Iran. So here you have a situation where as more and more of these societies are flexing around this empire that is crumbling, its various pillars are crumbling and stuff, just like in a tune that says diamonds are forever, but we know they're not forever. U.S. imperialism, as more and more people are trying to make clear to Sam, is not forever. So diamonds may be forever to some people, but imperial empires are not. And this is in part how things are geopolitically playing themselves out, and how the U.S., in response, is ratcheting up the threats to these particular regions more directly, like in Iran in this case, because he sees the deals that are going on with China with Russia. And these are some of the axes on the real scope that are becoming players that Brzezinski talked about, not allowing them to consolidate their power, that the neocons talked about, not allowing them to consolidate their power. The euro, that is more than consolidating its power and influence and growth, because its value is already above the U.S. dollar. So this is not about any particular individuals who are servants to the empire. This is about how the U.S. imperial machine, like the British machine, are structured, and what these empires do and will do to try to maintain their imperial hegemonic dominance, and the things that they will say as an excuse to maintain their dominance.
Secondly, first part of your question was Iran. Okay, good. Sometimes you mix them up, it throws us off balance, you know. I'm not going to prejudge what the United Nations Security Council should do. But I recognize that it's logical that a country which has rejected diplomatic entreaties be sent to the United Nations Security Council. I want to put it in this perspective. The UN Security Council is part of the diplomatic process started by Germany, France, and Great Britain, representing the interests of a lot of countries like ourselves, which made it abundantly clear to the Iranians that the development of the know-how and or a nuclear weapon was unacceptable. And the reason it's unacceptable is because Iran, armed with a nuclear weapon, poses a grave threat to the security of the world. And countries such as ours have an obligation to step up, working together, sending a common message to the Iranians that that it's their behavior, kind of trying to clandestinely develop a nuclear weapon, or using the guise of a civilian nuclear weapon program to get the know-how to develop a nuclear weapon, is unacceptable. And Germany's played an incredibly constructive role in this dialogue, and I want to thank the Chancellor for continuing that dialogue. As I say, we're working very carefully together in consultation about how to proceed next. One of the things friends do is they spend time discussing strategies before we make a common statement about what next ought to happen. And we spent a fair amount of time today, and I know Condi Rice has spent a fair amount of time with the current government, about strategizing. How best to achieve the objective. That's what we want to do. We want an end result to be acceptable, which will yield peace, which is that the Iranians not have a nuclear weapon.
We know what they consider the real bomb. Further collaboration between other societies that are trying to break free from the grip of the petrodollar scheme that they have been locked in, and the imperial military machine that is grinding over large portions of people's lives, as we see in Iraq. Now, as this thing starts to become more heated, you're going to see a situation where the U.S. is finding itself as China, you know, like the National Petroleum Corporation, has set up an oil pipeline running from Kazakhstan to northwest China in a major deal that undercut the geopolitical Washington-backed BTC oil pipeline plan. All these things that are playing out and are basically gaining more and more independence for China and other societies The U.S. is ratcheting up its military, and more conflict could easily, which is where this stuff is headed, blow up. Now, at a certain point, the U.S. is deeply industrialized its base, its society. Now, part of that was for disciplinary reasons. Others were just out of super greed. When it became locked in within, where it locked the world into a petrol dollar system, its major export has been exporting the dollar. So it could then go out and send those jobs to these other countries, because the other countries had to beat down their population to sell these goods back into the U.S. to try to get hold of the U.S. dollar to buy petroleum. But when you're in this type of stage that the U.S. is in, and you're creating more and more conflict, at a certain point, Sam is going to have to bring at least a portion of its industrial base back into the U.S. Because when you are creating war against all these different societies, you can't be producing steel in a society that you're at war with. You have to bring it back. And at that point, that's going to be a crucial juncture for the slaves on Sam's plantation. Because suddenly, he's going to be trying to put a good face on things, trying to open up certain industrial bases in rural and, of course, inner city neighborhoods where he's left them in the dust to rot and spatially deconcentrate. And then they're going to send in all their Sambos like Jesse Jackson, who are now going to say, hey, now it's time for us to get our good jobs. So, you know, and now it's opportunity to get steps ahead. But what this is really about is Sam gearing up for its wars and being entrenched in wars, and it needs internal labor power to fuel the industrial base to make the machinery and produce the steel that it would be locked out from doing in various societies that it has its industrial base in now, that is creating a situation where it could easily be in these major wars against. So my point is how we respond and don't respond to this will basically outline the next phase of whether there will be a future for the American Empire and its imperial system in the next phase of the century. Are we going to be building its new military revamp machine, or are we going to be building what we already got going in West Oakland? More head coffins for the machine. You know where we stand as slaves. It's time for us to build the coffin for Sam and lay him and all these privatizers throughout the planet to rest, and start working on and pushing out more alternative systems in development, free from the grips of this privatized order. Because regardless of how these things play out, unless they just light us all on fire in a nuclear holocaust, all of these societies in this privatized order are heading for various forms of collapse. And how we respond to these various forms of collapses basically will help outline in this sphere, and as I mentioned before, South America, where there's more and more openings and more outreach and more awareness at this present time that alternatives need to take place. These are some of the catalysts and avenues for us to start to partake in. Oh yeah, and one last thing. Stay armed. Until until the next time. Slave out.